Well, thank you for getting an opportunity to talk to you today. I'm going to kind of go through microbial risk assessment just to show you how that's done a little bit, and then viruses, and dealing with how you might use such a thing for coming up with standards and risk from reclaimed water and viruses. Most of this work is funded by the Department of Homeland Security and U.S. EPA Center for Advancing Microbial Risk Assessment, and as Romney mentioned, the WET Center at Temple, ASU, and U of A, right? Hope I got everybody in there, right? What's risk assessment? It's really an estimation of the potential of an adverse exposure to individuals or populations to any type of hazards, including microorganisms. What the approach to use to look at the risk from irrigation waters we reclaim is what we call quantitative microbial risk assessment. And that's an approach that allows expression of risk in quantitative fashion in terms of infection, illness, or mortality from microbial infections. Generally, we talk about microbial risk, we look at infection rather than illness or mortality, because the outcome of illness and mortality depends on the host. If you're immunocompromised individual, some common infections, you can have a 50% mortality. If you're like an elderly person, for example, or younger people, there may be almost no mortality. And microorganisms evolve all the time. So organism that might cause mild infections one year may cause very serious ones the next year. So generally, regulatory agencies have looked at risk of infection. Microbial risk assessment has actually been used quite a bit in recent years for setting standards for drinking water in particular, looking at cost benefits of treatment, assessment of various technologies, and relative risk between chemicals and microbes. And then, of course, this is put into a regulatory forum when we're trying to do it risks from foods and that. We want to put in a format, hopefully we don't scare the public all the time, we've referred that to risk management, but sometimes you don't succeed too well on that. So what's an acceptable risk from a waterborne pathogen? That's the first thing we want to really look at. At US EPA about 20 years ago now decided, well, a risk of 1 in 10,000 risk of infection per illness per year is what will be used as a guideline for drinking water. In other words, we'll treat drinking water to reduce the level of pathogens so the risk is no greater than 1 in 10,000 per year of infection. In other words, roughly saying a community of 10,000 will allow one person to get ill from the drinking water from a microorganism a year. And that'll be our guidance for how we treat the wastewater. Now, those standards don't go all over. If you look at recreational standards, which are based on illness rates, much higher level of acceptance there. About for marine waters, they're willing to accept 19 illnesses per 1,000 events or bathers, or about that's almost about a 1 in 50 risk. Why the difference? Well, you have the option of swimming in sewage polluted water or not, right? But you got to drink water every day. So the idea is some level, a higher level of risk is acceptable. For that. World Health Organization has looked at the risk of 1 in 1,000 per year for drinking water and for vegetables irrigated with reclaimed water, rather than a 1 in 10,000 risk. The reason why is they say, well, 1 in 10,000 is really hard to achieve in the developing world, so we should have a lower standard. That's what always makes me hesitant when people use this standard for reclaimed waters in developing countries that are designed for export. They do have a lower guidance standard that the World Health Organization has set than we might want to set for that. What about microbial risk assessment? Very similar to the chemical risk assessment, we identify a pathogen, we look at dose response data from humans. Fortunately, we don't have to use rats as much. We have graduate students and medical students who do anything for a buck. And so a lot of our work for viruses and bacteria I talk about were done in human beings. So we have a lot of confidence in our data. Actually, a lot of the animal data that people have done in comparison looks pretty good for dose response. And we do have quite a bit for waterborne pathogens. And then we can model the infection probability, and then we can use clinical data to estimate the probability of disease and mortality, and then we predict it. Fortunately, with microbial work, we can validate our models from outbreak data. We have data from foodborne outbreaks. We know how much virus, parasite, bacteria were in the food, and we know how many people got ill. And these models are uncannily accurate for predicting it. You can come sometimes right on the nose of predicting the number of people who get ill by these models. So we have a lot of confidence in our microbial models right now for that reason, because our ability to validate them. What about foodborne agents? I just want to make sure you understand, too, why the concern with viruses. It's believed almost 70% of all foodborne illness that you get is due to viruses. Now, you read about E. coli 0157 and Cryptosporidium, But epidemiological data has shown in every major country in the developed country in the world, viruses are the number one cause of foodborne illness by a long shot. Why that is, we still don't understand, because we believe these viruses only come from other human beings. So it's either got to be wastewater or food handlers that are contaminating them. But probably the reason, too, is the viruses are highly infectious. Fewer of them take a high probability of you becoming ill. Large number of viruses, it's growing every year. On an average, we discover 10 new waterborne agents per year, and about four or five of those or more are viruses every year. I used to give this lecture 10 years ago, and there were only 50 enteroviruses, or 101 last time I looked. And the list of them keep growing. New ones keep getting discovered, like Bako virus is now, Boca viruses are viruses that cause both diarrhea and respiratory illnesses. Some of these waterborne agents, too, are not just capable of causing diarrhea. Respiratory infections can be transmitted by water by these agents, very clear. For adenoviruses, you can get throat, nose, eye infections by exposure to the water. Fever, rash, meningitis, hand, foot, mouth disease, heart disease, paralysis, they've been associated with diabetes. You name it, any chemical that ever caused anything, a microbe did it a long time ago. And I always liked mental disorders. There was an outbreak of Alice in Wonderland syndrome. That's where everybody thinks they're in Wonderland, going around all the time. And what it is, because they affect the brain. And there was an outbreak in Wyoming. And of course, those guys think they're in Wonderland all the time, probably. But probably the number one virus we're always really concerned about is Norwalk virus, a major cause of adult diarrhea. Kind of looks like Darth Vader's diarrhea Death Star. And one of the concerns with this virus is you can get it over and over again. A lot of people think, well, I get ill, I get immune. You can get diarrhea as many times as you want in your life from this virus without it relenting. One of the concerns with this virus is a lot of these agents, this agent's become much more virulent in recent years. It's really the curse of the cruise ship lines. It causes a lot of problems in cruise ships. There's more people to feed on today in closer quarters, or these viruses are rapidly evolving. That's one of our concerns, is the rapid evolution of virulence in some of these agents. Now, how do we do quantitative microbial risk assessment on irrigation water? We look for the concentration of the pathogen in the irrigation water, method of irrigation, type of crop, survival on the crop, contamination of the during harvesting. Little data is available on that, so I can't talk too much about that, but I think that's more important than people have recognized, and survival on the crop after harvesting. Usually, we give zero inactivation after harvesting, because it's usually refrigerated, most of these crops, and the little inactivation occurs of pathogens after that. If you do microbial risk assessment, you look on certainty analysis, it tells you the concentration of the pathogen on the crop or irrigation water is the driving factor. That's where the greatest uncertainty occurs in this type of risk analysis. And so basically what we're always looking at is about contamination. Now, what microbial water quality standards we believe can be analyzed for reclaimed waters by looking at quantitative exposure data, method of irrigation, pathogen, and type of food crop. In our work, we've been looking at flood versus drip versus spray in crops like cantaloupe, lettuce, and bell pepper are three that we've focused on in recent years. And we look for all kinds of pathogens. HAV is hepatitis A virus. PRD1 is a model we're using, hopefully to validate so we don't have to use hepatitis virus all the time. Khaleesi virus, you use feline Khaleesi as a model for human norovirus. It's hard to work with that virus because it doesn't grow well in cell culture. It goes great in graduate students, but cell culture is a little tough to do it. And the paperwork is actually less on graduate students than animals. So. But hepatitis A we picked here because it survives so well in the environment. We haven't seen many viruses survive better than this. And it's been involved in outbreaks foodborne before. And so we assessed the contamination of the crop during irrigation and survival. We were interested a lot in the field in methods of irrigation, flood irrigation versus drip irrigation for these. Now, these drip lines have to be pretty close to the surface, unfortunately, for a lot of this type of produce we were looking at that results in contamination of the crop. We conducted both field work, as you've seen here, where we actually irrigate with dilute wastewater and then we seed in all the agents that we want. For some of the more hazardous agents, we use indoor situations in that because we just can't put hepatitis A virus out in the field, you know, and take the chance it might get windborne or something like that. So we also do indoor experiments. and we can irrigate by different methods. Unfortunately, with shallow drip irrigation, you get the water to the surface, and we still got contamination of the lettuce with the provincial upward flow apparently going on. Sometimes we use environmental growth changers if we're working with really hazardous agents like E. coli 0157, for example, and some of the more virulent viruses that we work with and parasites, so we can actually get an idea of survival. This kind of gives you an idea of the survival. I just wanted to point it out for the different methods. PRD1 was the virus we were using here rather than hepatitis A, because we found it survived very similar to hepatitis A virus, and we could add more of it and it was less hazardous versus E. coli. Clostridium perfringens is the CP. That's a spore organism. We wanted to look at something that was very hardy. We compared subsurface drip irrigation to flood irrigation here. If you notice, the PRD1 did irrigate with subsurface drip irrigation, did contaminate the cantaloupe, and did contaminate the lettuce. And we actually got some on the bell pepper, too. Sometimes it's hard for us to visualize that, but people are moving through these crops, too, and taking care of them. We sometimes believe that stirring up the soil and their foot movement and other movement going on. Surface contamination, too, occurs very readily whether you're doing drip or subsurface, particularly for viruses. Viruses do migrate to the soil surface much greater than the bacteria, we found out. That was one issue we felt was overlooked. With subsurface irrigation, is really taking a harder look at viruses, particularly in arid climates where it's fairly dry in that. We did see surface contamination. Survival is hepatitis A virus, feline calicii, PRD1 virus. If you notice here, over 14 days from an irrigation event here where the cantaloupe was contaminated, there was no decrease in the hepatitis A concentration on the cantaloupe samples. I'm sorry I didn't put standard deviations on here, but and this is PRD1, which we were using as a model for hepatitis A. We did get some die-off, about 99.9% here of the feline calicii viruses, so they seem to be more susceptible. But hepatitis A was the one to look at, too, is basically. And these were in environmental chambers trying to simulate outdoor conditions, by the way. So these viruses were very stable in the field, growing on the plant. These are growing plants, by the way, on it. But they were even more stable, we felt, in the soil. If I'm trying to pick out just PRD1 here, it came down. You get some variability in here. Rainfall events outside tend to splash things out here, too, and flood irrigation events. So flood irrigation, rainfall events threw the viruses onto the plants, we're guessing, from some of the work that we saw, too. So that was another overlooked factor. Inactivation rates, we looked at humid and dry conditions for bell pepper, lettuce, E. coli, and PRD1 in this case. Fairly stable for the PRD1 again. Much more stable than some of the bacterial agents. Moving through this quickly, basically, highest to low level contamination, cantaloupe was the thing that got contaminated the most. Lettuce least, and bell pepper least, because it grows above the soil. I mean, cantaloupe's really bad. I haven't shown all the data here, but like E. coli 0157 and salmonella will grow on the rind, actually, under field conditions from what we found. And it gets very heavily contaminated. I mean, really, if Eve wanted to do an Adam, you should have gave him a cantaloupe. That's from what I can figure out, because that seems to be the most easily contaminated of all the produce we've ever studied. And things survive longer because it's a rough surface, you can't decontaminate it. So it seems to be the worst as far as getting contaminated. Greater contamination in flood irrigation plots, of course, but we still saw it in subsurface drift with the depths that we were putting it in. Pathogens survive longer in the soil than on the crops, and which created a concern with us that maybe more research needs to be done on looking at how harvesting affects contamination of crops that might be irrigated. Conclusion, cantaloupe is more likely to get contaminated. Subsurface drip irrigation does reduce contamination by 99.9%. Okay, this gives you a rough idea here. One reason we concentrated on viruses is if you look on survival, everything survives on cantaloupe. HAV just does great outside, under simulated and outside field conditions. It doesn't really get inactivated at all on the crop from what we could see. Very stable virus in the situation. So if you get it in reclaimed water, then you're going to have to worry about it. So it's one of the organisms you might want to target. basically each organism survived at least 14 days at least one experiment. Hepatitis A and the colophage PRD1 overall survived the longest, so PRD1 may be a good model if you can't work with animal viruses. C. perfringens also survived very long because it was a spore former, and that might be a useful model too for some applications. Now, how do you use this data? You generate it, you get an idea of the survivability, how much gets contaminated. So what happens if we want to set a risk of somebody not getting infection, but 1 in 10,000, the risk of infection? That's the acceptable level we're going to accept per year for it. Well, we can look at how much produce is consumed, the percent of transfer of the pathogen from the irrigation water, depending on the method, to the crop. And if I pick salmonella here, and I looked at salmonella, I looked at decay rates, die-off, whether it was harvest 1 or 14 days after it was irrigated. So I put in die-off as a factor. Note activation or growth post-harvest because it goes into a refrigerator. If you did this and if you wanted a 1 in 10,000 risk, if you harvested one day after, you should have no more than 150 salmonella per 100 milliliters. Since you get a lot of die-off of salmonella, you can apparently irrigate these waters with a lot of salmonella if you wanted to take the chance here, at least based on our risk analysis. What did it mean for salmonella in different types of irrigation water for vegetables? It depends on the produce you're working. You can tolerate far more salmonella, if you believe it, if you irrigate lettuce in the water than you could cantaloupe, because cantaloupe was more easily contaminated than lettuce, which surprised us. But what about viruses? Viruses, because it takes fewer of them, they have a high probability of causing infection. Very low numbers, basically no more than 2 viruses per 10 liters of water you're going to put on irrigate with cantaloupe, or maybe 42 per 10 liters that you would put on lettuce. So in other words, if you're going to use reclaimed water, you would have to at least treat it to those levels to assure you don't have viruses at those levels, if your aim is to get to that 1 in 10,000 risk level. Are those high levels of viruses? Relatively speaking, yes and no. Depends how well you treat the wastewater and you chlorinate. But I think given most water reclamation plants of filtration, extended chlorination, those should be easily met. The issue becomes your reliability of producing that. Basically, one of the things that we felt overall, if you're going to irrigate with reclaimed water, you have to consider the crop and the risk to that crop. If you're going to use reclaimed water for one purpose and for one crop versus another, you might want to have different standards, or your standard's going to have to be set for the worst case crop. So basically, consider development of different water quality standards for sensitive crops. Now, you could go to the extreme and take your most sensitive crop, what we claim water, and use that. You said that's good for all. Assessment of impact of harvesting has been overlooked, I think. And our data indicates that a lot of contamination may occur during that event, and it probably data should be gathered for risk analysis. Drip irrigation did not offer equal protection to all crops from all pathogens. So that can't be necessarily a solution. One of the other issues that's coming up very rapidly is the use of UV light for disinfecting reclaimed waters. Unfortunately, some viruses are extremely resistant, like adenoviruses. The levels currently used are far from adequate to eliminate adenoviruses. And what we're seeing is lots of viruses coming through UV light reclamation plants now in the water because they switched to UV light from chlorine. Well, adenoviruses are hardly touched by the UV light doses used at those plants. So that has to be considered. If you're going to use UV light, you might have to reconsider virus risk assessment if you're going to move away from chlorine or reduce your chlorine levels, because some viruses are extremely resistant. Adenoviruses are the most UV light resistant waterborne agents known. But there's other viruses that have recently been discovered, like pico, biRNA, and viruses, small double-stranded RNA viruses that should be very resistant to UV light. Boca viruses, recently discovered in the last 5 years, are small DNA viruses, which are capable of maybe being repaired by enzyme mechanisms in human cells that have to really be looked at. The other thing is the impact of plant viruses on human health. The most dominant viruses are found in reclaimed water are plant viruses. Now, not so much, some people have, well, that may be issues with plants you're irrigating, like tomato viruses and pepper viruses are very common. But a recent study indicated there might be health implications from this too. It seems to be some type of maybe autoimmune relationships in the gut causing illnesses or symptoms with people who have higher numbers of tomato viruses in their diet, believe it or not. And this was recently discovered by using metagenomics. Treatment plant reliability is an issue with viruses. You know, unlike chemicals, if you have suboptimal operation just for a few minutes, that allows a lot of pathogens to go through. And it's been shown in drinking water treatment plants, suboptimal operation for just short periods of time can result in exposure to an entire community and explain a lot of the illnesses seen in a community. So treatment plant reliability has to be in any risk assessment today for reclaimed waters. They've got to be able to produce that level of virus you're aiming for as much as possible. I wanted to end it quickly. It seems rapidly driving our perceptions of reclaimed water and microorganisms is the risk assessment itself, because that's capable of being done today with reasonable assurances. We have some idea of what the risks are. Water quality sensors real time are changing. They're going to really be essential in the future for treatment plant reliability. Metagenomics is completely changing our whole idea. We can now look for anything in the drink, in the reclaimed water, viruses of any type that we know about exists now. And also, viruses are being more and more associated with chronic long-term disease, which probably is going to have to be put in the risk analysis here. And in treatment processes, anytime you're changing a treatment process, particularly new disinfectant systems I see coming in, we have to reevaluate the ability of viruses to penetrate these systems. That's going to be critical to risk assessment in the future. Thank you.
We have time for one quick question. Your boss.
My question is related to the internalization of some of the pathogens inside the food source, especially with salmonella in tomatoes. I wonder if you have any ideas or data that if you use reclaimed water versus the regular fresh water, is there a higher risk?
Yeah, there's been a lot of work done on internalization of bacteria in that, but, you know, based on back of the envelope risk assessment, the levels are just so low is that the risks are not going to be significant. I think, to be really honest, too much work has been gone to this internalization effect, for the numbers of organisms are really small we're talking about. If you run a risk analysis on the, if you do the percentage people, the organisms get internal, it's really small. Now, it hasn't been done for viruses, though. Now, that may make it a little bit different, but the levels of bacteria would have to be pretty high for internalization to have a really big impact on the crops in terms of human risk of it. Although that's receiving a lot of attention right now, for certain.
Thanks. Thank you, Dr.